And he is a recognized scholar and author in the field of the cults. Jim's written several books. And he serves on the board at this present time of PFO, Personal Freedom Outreach. And we're very honored to have Brother Jim Bjornstad with us today, speaking on Pastor Russell's Surrender, Eternal Torment and Christianity Loses. Brother Jim.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit of background coming up to the message for tonight, this afternoon tonight. I don't know where I am anyway, I guess. To begin with, in terms of dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses and cults, I was in college in New Jersey and was dating a young lady named Becky. And Becky was the babysitter for Walla Martin and took care of all of his children. And so I got to know Walter and to work with him. And hard to believe. It actually goes back. The association began 1965. And that's a long, long, long time ago. And I kept thinking yesterday when I watched Raphael up here, it's nice to see a younger generation coming up behind those of us that were here back at the time of the flood and the dinosaurs and all the rest. But anyway, working with Walter, I got, of course, to meet Bill Setnar. And how did I get here at those conferences in the beginning? It was very easy. Walter would say something, and Walter didn't come. And so Bill would say, look, I'll trade you. I'll teach your class at Northeastern if you will come over and speak at my convention. That's how I got drawn into it to begin with. That was an interesting group of people. I remember Jaeger particularly because he belonged to what was called Mensa. And Mensa, those people that have high IQs. And so back at that conference, I remember they were talking about his IQ. And then I'd hear some people say, so what? And then I'd hear other people say, wow. You know, it was just interesting just to listen to this. But I have to tell you, when I came out here to the conference the first time, I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn in particular, not far from the Watchtower headquarters. Number two, I lived in New Jersey, a fairly populous type of community. And I come out this way, and I'm driving out this way to this place. And when I came here, I thought to myself, is there going to be anybody here? And it was kind of surprising, as I heard even last night, to see the number of people that were present here. It was good. And so that was the beginning of it, and I began to realize the importance of it. And out of that came a lot of other ex-groups, ex-Mormons for Jesus, ex-Christian Scientists for Jesus, and other groups as well that formed these support groups. So you think back 25 years, it's hard to believe. There are times when I think that I'm 25, but my body doesn't let me get away with it. And so I know that that's not true. But back at that time, Bill used to say, and I would say to Bill, what do you want me to talk on? And Bill would say, you know, we need the academic people. We need you to come out, and we need you to do certain topics. You know, we have lots of testimonies and different things, but to cover certain topics that are of import to Jehovah's Witnesses. And so that was the way that it began. And I guess even the thinking of today, when I began to think of the topics, what could I share really that might be helpful to you? And this is more academic than it really is preaching and whatever, and so you'll hear that as you go along. But I thought back in the beginning that Charles Taze Russell, as the story begins, had that encounter in which he lost the debate. And it was at that time that he gave up on the doctrine of hell, but also on Christianity. And I'll take you through the steps of it. When he did that, he reformulated this theology, and that's what became the theology of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And not only did it become the theology of the Jehovah's Witnesses, it takes its way all the way through to today. There is no break with 1931 and Judge Rutherford. It's exactly the same basis of theology that you had with Charles Taze Russell. And so, tracking it through and beginning to think about it, there are certain things that he taught that happened back at that time that I think, in a sense, affect Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, because there are things that are still in their mind that have been taught to them by the Watchtower. And so it was with that in mind that I wanted to try to put this together, and so that's why I just simply said Pastor Russell surrenders. And we could just add the other part by saying, out the window goes eternal torment, but so does also Christianity in that. So it's going to be a little while as we go through this to pick up on all of the parts, but I hope that it's valuable for you. Well, here we go anyway with the story. And there are several parts to it as we go. Number one, going back in Charles Taze Russell's life, born in 1852 in the state of Pennsylvania. And in looking at his background and trying to trace as much of it as I can, I know that his parents were, as best you can tell, Christians. And Joseph L. and Eliza Burney Russell attended a church. And the church was evangelical, and it was also Reformed. It was a church that was known for preaching hellfire and brimstone. And that was called the Allegheny City Congregational Church. That's as far back as you can check in newspapers and things to get an idea of the background. With regard to Russell's beliefs at that time, as he was growing up, Let God Be True, 1952 edition, page 210, indicates the fact that as a child he developed a keen interest in theology. And it says at a young age. But the one that intrigues me a little bit more about this is the account given by a follower of his named E.B. Stewart. And the article is entitled Life of Pastor Russell. It's in the Overland Monthly, February 1917. Page 129, 130. And what it says is that basically he believed the doctrines of the Christian faith. And it goes on to describe those doctrines as the very doctrines that the people who are opposed to him hold today. In other words, he gave up the doctrines that Christianity holds to. And so you get something of that background that occurs. And the question might be, at what point in his life did he give those up? What was it that caused him to retract, to move away from Christianity, to reject it? And if you track his journey, it seems that it occurs at age 16. And as the story goes, he had a friend. And he describes that friend as being an infidel, as one who rejected Christianity. And so he went to try to win his friend, and at that time, in this discussion or debate, as sometimes it's called, he says that he was completely routed, which means that he was beaten badly in the debate. And as you go on, Stewart, one of the followers of his in that 1917 article, makes the comment that as long as the doctrine of eternal torment is taught, Charles Taze Russell could not believe the Bible. And so you begin to get the idea that what occurred in that debate was the very fact of the doctrine of eternal torment. Hell sort of will grow out of his rejection of it, his misunderstanding of hell. But he loses basically on this doctrine. And then I began to think to myself, what exactly was it that happened? What were the points that he got beaten so badly on that caused him to change? And in Studies in the Scriptures, Volume 1, this is the 1886 edition, it's on page 1, he makes this statement. Russell says, a loving God that would use his power to create human beings, whom he foreknew and predestined should be eternally tormented, could be neither wise, just, or loving. His standard would be lower than that of any man. Now, I'd like you to notice a couple of things in that quote. Number one, you have something of the idea of Calvinism, the background of the church that he was a part of, because he speaks about the fact of foreknew and the idea of predestined to be eternally tormented. And so you get something of the background of the church, and he begins to get this feeling that if there's a God like that, then he does not want it. So it gives you something of what he's fighting against and what he's going to lose in this. And so his Calvinism, I think, is quite clear right from the beginning. At that point, if you know the story of his life, he basically gives up on the Bible and the church. And what he does is there seems to be a hiatus for a small time period. And then at age 18, He has a recovery of some sort. And what happens at that time is that he goes to listen to a Second Adventist speak. Now, Second Adventists, there are a lot of them around. Second Adventists are not the same as Seventh Day. A Second Advent is one who believes in the return of Christ. And in the 19th century, these were people that went around proclaiming the fact that Christ would return, and they even set dates. And one of those, of course, would have been the Millerites. Now, talking to Philip just a little bit before, out by State College, there is actually one of the old Millerite churches that goes back to about the time period, and actually back before the time period of Charles Taze Russell. And Miller was one, of course, who proclaimed the return of Christ. And Seventh-day Adventist has some connection with that. He was never a Seventh-day Adventist. He was a Baptist. But they certainly picked up on parts of his teaching. And so at this time, there were a number of these Adventists that were walking around. And one of them, named Jonas Wendell, is the one that happens to be preaching when Charles Taze Russell goes to hear. And when he listens to him, he, in a sense, receives some new light and on eternal torment. Number one, by this time, the Adventist had formulated the idea of soul sleep. That is, that in the time period between death and resurrection, there was no conscious existence of man. And Charles Taze Russell liked that, because then there could be nothing that was tormented, and it gets him out of this problem of Calvinism and the predestined tormation, the tormenting and all the rest. The second part that they had developed by that time was the idea that the wicked are annihilated at the resurrection. And so he picked up on that as well. And it's interesting that at that point it renews his interest in the Bible. It's only a short time later that he's actually going to have his first Bible study, and from there he's going to begin to put together his theology. And so as you look back at this, it seems that as you're looking at his life, he grows up somewhat in evangelical Christianity. And then what happens is at age 16, believing, they would say, the same doctrines that his detractors believe today, now all of a sudden, at age 16, it's a crisis. And because of it, he gives up. And then a year later, he hears an Adventist and he's back and he begins to formulate his theology. And the reformulation of his theology is interesting. This is my own personal reconstruction of what happened, of how we get to where we are today in Watchtower theology. But my basic understanding of it is something like this, that Russell, and this is as best I can tell from all the data that you have, that Russell started out with an extreme hatred for the idea of eternal torment. In fact, I would say that that is probably the doctrine that the Watchtower hates the most, because they make fun of it, they reduce it to absurdity, and all the rest. It seems to me that if torment is not eternal, then there is no place where it occurs, and so hell becomes the grave. If there's no conscious existence, because torment is not eternal, well, let me put it this way, if torment is not eternal, there's no place where it occurs. But if it's not eternal, then there can be nothing that survives death that can be tormented. And so the Jehovah's Witnesses, Charles Taze Russell, developed the idea that man does not have a soul, because nothing can survive death to be tormented. The moment that you do that, you have a little bit of a problem. Because if when someone dies, conscious existence ceases, then the question is, what about Jesus when he died? And if Jesus ceased to exist, then the next point is, he could not be God. So in other words, if you want to get rid of eternal torment, it would seem to me that you have to get rid of anything that can be tormented. So man does not have a soul. But if man does not have a soul that exists after death, then what happened when Jesus died? And so the argument would be, when Jesus died, he ceased to exist. But if Jesus is God, he cannot cease to exist. Therefore, Jesus is not God. I mean, you've heard the statement from Let God Be True, haven't you? Who ruled the universe the 3 days and three nights that Jesus was in the grave, in the tomb? And then the next part of it would go this way. If Jesus is not God, then this idea of the Trinity obviously is heresy. There cannot be three persons, one God. But then it goes a little bit further, I think. And I think I can make the extension, perhaps it's a little bit of a leap, in which you would say if Jesus is not God, then he was really nothing more than man when he was here. And so whatever work he accomplishes is somewhat in a human fashion. It cannot be eternal, and it cannot be infinite, because only God could provide that type of redemption. And so it ends up reducing the understanding of salvation. And you end up really in their theology in the sense whereby man has a part in this, and man works for his salvation. And so what I began to see in the process, in the development of this, was a reformulation of theology. If I put it the other way, it'd say something like this, you know, God exists as one person. Jesus is not God, but to make him important, of course, he's Michael the Archangel, the first created. Man is a physical being, but when he dies, he ceases to exist. Hell is the grave. Salvation is man's doing. Not something that really is provided by God, in the sense, of course, that Charles Taze Russell once held it. So in the midst of all of that, you have this development. And I would argue and say this is true of Jehovah's Witnesses. If you want to see the next part of it, look at Judge Rutherford, the Harp of God, because he says basically the same things that Russell said. So let's not have anything of this business of saying that, we're not Russellites, in a sense. They've accepted his theology, and it continues all the way through. But in the process, Russell went a little bit further. And as he develops his doctrine on eternal torment, his rejection of it, he makes these statements. Number one, it's unreasonable. And, of course, you've heard that. And you probably know the arguments as well as I do, and better. It's repugnant to justice. It's contrary to the principle of love. It is entirely unscriptural. That's exactly what Russell said. That's what Rutherford says in the Harp of God, and I would say that's probably what you have heard all the way through as well. So it's the same teaching that has made its way through. Now to go back for a little while and to look at his rejection of eternal torment, to revisit that part. Going back to think of it, number one of the problems that he has is a misunderstanding of the attributes of God. And I want to come back to that in a moment. A second thing that is a problem for him is his concept of hell as literal. And I want to come back and revisit that as well, too. But first of all, his misunderstanding of the attributes of God. In the Bible, when you look at the attributes of God, they're very clear. And, of course, we can pull them from various passages and things that are said about God. But what happens all too frequently is that people choose certain ones that they like. And so some people like to stress Jonathan Edwards, John Piper today, the holiness of God as the premier attribute of God. There are others that have some other favorites. There are those that like the idea of justice. There are those that like the idea of punishment that would come from that, that would stress the wrath of God. There are other people that would look at it and say, well, I like the idea of the love of God. The truth of the matter is that God is, in nature, every one of those attributes. In other words, all the attributes are God. They're intrinsic to Him. It's His nature. And sometimes we create things by saying you play one attribute against another. And it seems to me that people do that. And so I like love, and so I'll just ignore that one that deals with the justice of God. Or I like the holiness, but I don't want these over here. Fact of the matter is that God is all of those attributes at one time. Need to be careful how we divide them up. And one of the problems that Russell has is that he does the very things that I've mentioned. He chooses one over the other, and he hangs tight on it. So that he would say, for example, this. He would say that love is the all-important attribute of God. That was his favorite. Now, I mean, you heard this a little bit going back, if you remember the statement from studies in the Scriptures. A loving God that would use his power to create human beings whom he foreknew and predestined should be eternally tormented, could be neither wise, just, nor loving. And the real quest of it is over the fact of the love of God. He goes on to say that all of God's actions are motivated by love. By love. And then the argument is that eternal conscious punishment or torment is inconsistent with the love of God. I'm going to argue in the end that it's consistent with the love of God. But I just wanted to tell you what I think one of the mistakes is as he begins. And that is he does what lots of people do today. And they hang everything on one and then they reinterpret or make everything to fit around that one. That's exactly what Charles Taze Russell did. So he made a mistake theologically. I don't want to ride on this too heavily, but of course he was against any formal education biblically or anything else. Just in reading some of his things, had little value for people who had any formal theological training. But it probably would have helped him a little bit in his understanding if he had some theology that would have helped in that. The second one that's very crucial in this is his concept of hell as being literal. By being literal, I would say take it at face value as the words existed at that time. Of course, he would take that to be at this time. And I think you can see it best in some of the teachings and probably some of the stories that you've used through the years. But it's something like the idea of this. If you have a dog that happens to not be trained too well and he piddles kind of regularly on your rug in your house, you might want to put him on a spittle and roast him over a fire. And you would say, well, I'd never do that. I love my pet too much, whatever the pet's name is, or whatever, Fluffy or whatever. Okay. I'd never do it. Well, you've used that, haven't you? But I think there are Jehovah's Witnesses who actually practice in the Kingdom Hall to have a glee in their eye when they say that so that they'll evoke some emotion from those of us that are not witnesses. You know, say, well, how could you do that? And I mean, if you wouldn't do that, God certainly wouldn't do that. And so you get something of the literalness of it, or as John Stott might say today, what all of the incinerators of the world bear witness to. Literal type of fire and burning and all the rest. And so that's the second part that causes some problems. And so I'd like to visit that for a little while and talk about the aspects of eternal torment and hell. There are basically four ways to approach the subject of hell and eternal torment. The first view is literal. The second is metaphoric. The third one is purgatorial. And the fourth one is conditional. In the first view, literal, it means simply to take it at face value. And most of the time, we do it in light of the culture that we live in. Although, to be honest, you should go back to the time period in the first century to look at it to see what it is. But we take it at its face value. That's basically the idea that you have the common sense approach. And so, if that's true, then what happens is we think of it basically as fire, because fire is mentioned. And you hear the stories of going out to the Valley of Hinnom, and you go out to the garbage pit where the garbage was tossed. And so that's the picture that you get in the midst of this, is that type of fire, a literalness. Now, I think one of the best expressions of literalness might be Islam, if you've never listened to them. But in Islam, for instance, because we'll look at the passage in Mark 9 in a moment, you know, if your hand offends you, what do? Cut it off, okay? So in some Arabic countries, the laws indicate that if you get caught stealing, you get your hand cut off. If you live in Iraq, and you probably remember the story, it's not too much long ago, a few months back, when there was a woman who said something kind about the troops, our troops, and her tongue was cut out. Remember that? Well, if your tongue offends Islam, cut it out. Well, here's hell, if you're interested in it. Their concept. This is in Surah chapter 4, ayat, that's verse 56. As often as their skins are roasted through, we shall change them for fresh skins, that they may taste the chastisement. Here's the picture. That they get roasted continuously. And when the skins fall off because they can't take any more, we put new skins on them and we roast them again. And you know what it says in there? Infidels will desire to die, but it will not be afforded to them. That's pretty literal in its understanding. And I think that would illustrate that view that you have. And it would probably illustrate the idea of what you're thinking about, putting a person on a spittle. And Dante's Inferno, I think, adds a lot to these things, going back in time, to give us the idea of the fire. So a literal approach would be that way. A metaphoric approach basically says that it's metaphor, it's a figure of speech. By figure of speech, please do not misunderstand. If you say it is metaphoric, it's real. It just is not the exact way that the language is. And so a metaphor is a comparison figure. You have two or more entities that are implicitly compared. And it might be something, for instance, when you would talk about Herod, and it speaks of Herod, and it says, Herod that sly fox. And you think to yourself, well, what kind of fox was he? After all, Herod was one of those rulers. Was he a red fox, or what kind of fox would he be? Or when it says that Jesus is the bread of life, what does that mean with regard to Jesus? It certainly doesn't mean that he's white bread or rye bread, probably Jewish rye, whole wheat or whatever the case would be. But it does indicate something about Jesus that relates to bread. Could it be something like that that we're talking about in these passages? So, metaphoric, again, I just want to stress the point, because usually when figurative language is said, the first thing people said, you don't believe that hell is real. Actually, I think it's worse than fire, if the metaphoric view is correct. The purgatorial view, the third one, takes the idea of the Catholic Church, that in order for a person to enter into heaven, he must pay the price, be purged of the sins that he has that are left. In Roman Catholic theology, going back to the Council of Trent, which I do not see as being alleviated or denied in Vatican II, basically would say that if you die with mortal sins that are unconfessed, you will go to hell. But if you die with venial sins, that you will go through purgatory. If all sins are confessed, you make it to heaven. And so purgatory is a place where, and you've seen the fires and the pictures, if you know anything of the background of this that happens, where they are purged of their sins. And so that particular position, there are those that would say, but how do you make it to heaven? You know, without being perfect. And so you got to go through this. Roman Catholic view. The fourth view is somewhat conditional. And Clark Pinnock is probably the best example of this. He argues basically that to have justice and fairness means that there must be something of an equal basis. And so why should somebody be punished for a lifetime of sins eternally? In other words, a lifetime of sins does not equate with an eternity of punishment. And so what he wants to do is reduce the part so that there is an end to it conditionally. And those are basically the four views that you have that are portrayed. In Christian and evangelical circles, the first two are the key views. Number one, the idea of literal, and the second is the idea of metaphoric. So, how do you decide in some of these texts? Well, let me give you a basis of methodology to begin with for decisions. Because if you accept the rules that are generally used in what is called hermeneutics or biblical interpretation, it will help. The first rule that you have is this, that the language in the Bible is to be taken as literal, at face value, unless there is a compelling reason not to do so. Now, why start with that rule? Because if you start with the idea that it is figurative, you will never get to the place that there is literal language. That's the problem. So you begin with the language at face value as though it is literal until there is something that indicates otherwise. For example, one of the things would be something like this. If a statement would be obviously irrational, unreasonable, or absurd, you might think about it being figurative or a secondary sense. You might think of that, for instance, when you look at Herod as the fox, because you would know that he would be a ruler and not a fox. So if the statement itself, if you're looking at it and you say, huh? Well, you know that it's metaphoric. The second one is if the context indicates that language is figurative. And let me give you a couple of examples of this. In John chapter 10 and verse 6, the context is very clear about the statement. In John 10:6, Jesus has just spoken of sheep and shepherd, and the one that enters in through the door is the shepherd of the sheep. Okay? And then there are those that try to come in another way. Verse 6, this figure of speech, Jesus spoke to them, but they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them. Now, it should be obvious that you're going to take that as a figure of speech, simply because the text says that you should. The second one would be something like Galatians chapter 4. And in Galatians chapter 4, you have this statement that's made in verse 24. This is allegorically speaking, for these women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now, Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, corresponds to present Jerusalem, and so forth and so on, but to be taken as allegory. So, at number one, as you read statements, there are sometimes when it seems kind of absurd, for instance, say, Jesus is bread, he is whole wheat bread. Yeah. You know that it's not that, but you know there is something that compares with bread. And so, if you think of it in that sense, the language itself, many times, just in reading the statement, clarifies it. But then sometimes it's the context that gives it away and says that you ought to consider this as being that which is metaphoric or figurative. The third one is this. If there is a contradiction with the clearer and more enduring emphasis of scriptures, it is legitimate to ask the question of whether or not this is figurative. In other words, if when you look at the teaching that's there, it doesn't square with some major emphasis of teaching, then you maybe want to look at it in a different sense. Where this comes up so frequently probably is more in eschatology at times, where people would say that in Revelation 20 you cannot take the 1,000 years as being literal. And the reason that they're saying that is because they know that it relates to Israel. And what happens before, in other places, they would say the Bible is clear in teaching that Israel failed, God gave up on Israel, the church has replaced Israel, therefore it cannot be a 1,000-year period. And by the way, in the language of that passage, I don't know if you looked at it, but it talks about 1,000 years, talks about 2 resurrections. This is the first resurrection. Well, if you have 2 resurrections, if the second resurrection is clearly physical resurrection of the body, and you say the 1,000 years is a long period of time, then what do you do with the first resurrection? Because amillennial and postmillennial views say, well, it's spiritual resurrection. People who are born again throughout history. But why would one be physical resurrection of the body and the other one not? Why would that be true? You can get into the whole thing, but it grows out of a lot of times an idea that is taught elsewhere, to which it gets carried over and then becomes the basis for saying, for instance, don't take the 1,000 years as literal, take it as many. In both views, from the ascension of Christ to the fact of Christ returning and establishing the eternal state. That's what it becomes. So you have three basic principles. Number one, if it seems to be absurd or irrational or whatever, then consider it figurative and look at it that way. Number two, if the context indicates, then if that's clear, you have no question. And thirdly, if there are other areas in Scripture that seem to conflict with that, you might want to consider whether that is literal or not. You raise the question at that point. Well, here we go. Which view, then, do we take with regard to hell? Well, the passage that I'd like to look at is the passage in Mark chapter 9. And because it uses some language, there are other passages I could use as well for this. But in Mark chapter 9, it's an interesting passage. If you start to read through, we'll start at verse 43 and then read through to verse 48. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than having your two hands to go into hell, into the unquenchable fire, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than having your two feet to be cast into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your eye causes you to stumble, cast it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Now, the phrase, where their worm does not die, the fire is not quenched. You'll notice that in verses 44 and 46, actually it's in brackets, it is not there in the earliest manuscripts. But it is there in verse 48. And so, as best I can tell, a scribe added to make the points after each of those. But it is interesting language. Because if you begin to look at the language that is there, it says, their worm does not die. Undying worms. The fire is not quenched. Now, I have students that at times will say, well, you know, remember the burning bush? And it didn't burn, you know. There's an example, little fire. Or the fourth man with the three in Daniel's in that fire, you know, the one like the Son of Man walking around. And so they say, see, look, it didn't burn, the three that were there. And they're good examples. I mean, God can do tremendous things. So if you were to say literal, could God produce that type of situation in literal fire? Yeah, he could. Because God is a God who is all-powerful. There isn't any question that he could do that. But I think in terms of the language here, when it uses that language, it indicates a little bit more to us. It seems to differentiate, because every fire that you and I know, if there were worms in it, would burn them up. And secondly, every fire that we know, unless you feed it and whatever, it's going to die out. If annihilation is true and whatever, you throw them in and they're destroyed, then the fire goes out sometime. We run out of fuel. So how do you explain those phrases? And what I'm trying to say is I think those phrases indicate something that's beyond even what we would call the idea of fire that we have. I think it indicates something more than that. And that's where I'd like to go in a moment with it. But there is some background to this. If you go back to Isaiah chapter 66, and I know some of you have looked at this text, you have an account that speaks of worms and corpses and all the rest. Well, let me get to it. In Isaiah 66, if you look at verse 24, then they shall go forth and look on the corpses of the men who have transgressed against me, for their worms shall not die and their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all mankind. Well, here is something of judgment and punishment that is spoken of. Now, I remember last year, and I have to apologize to somebody, I wrote this on my name tag, and I don't know about you, but when you get little pieces of paper, sometimes you lose them, and I do. And it was the statement that it's just corpses, you know, that you have that are sort of punished forever and ever. I'd have to come back and visit that idea. But notice the idea of the worm not dying and the fire not being quenched. It's a background. Certainly Mark has that in mind as he writes in chapter 9. Secondly, at that time, and Judith and the other passage would be Sirach. Now, understand, Apocrypha, I know it's not biblical, but it is part of the background of Judaism from which Mark will write. And he does have some understanding of this. And if you read Judith 16, 17, it speaks of judgment and punishment. And I'd like you just to note the words that it has in that text. It refers to it as the place where they will weep in pain forever. That's the quote. If you go out to Sirach, Sirach basically speaks of judgment and punishment and mentions the worm and mentions the fire as well. And so it seems to me that when you start to look at this, the unquenchable fire, what would the unquenchable fire be? Something that does not destroy what is there. I have an idea. It's something like the idea of an insatiable desire for self-destruction. That is, the person would love to be destroyed, but that's not going to be possible in terms of this. It's the idea of dead bodies and maggots and all the rest, where the maggots eat the body and they continue and they continue and they continue. Whatever it is will eat at you forever and ever. And I'm going to say it's simply your imperfections and all the rest that you have. And I'll come back in a moment to that. But there is the idea, I think Ezekiel 28, 18, reference perhaps to Satan and the king of Tyre. And in the text it talks about fire inside. And just the burning, the desire that would be there. So unquenchable fire, and then the undying worm. Continual process of just eating at you might be the idea of it. One of the passages I thought might fit a little bit with this. I didn't see any commentary that mentions it. But did you ever look at the death of Herod in Acts 12? If you look at Herod's death, this is a comment I want to make about this. But in verse 20, this is Acts 12. Now he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and with one accord they came to him. And having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they were asking for peace, because their country was fed by the king's country. And on an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat at the rostrum and began delivering an address to them. And the people kept crying out, "This voice, the voice of a god and not of man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him, because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and died. Josephus and Antiquities, 343 and following, talks about it and says that it took several days for him to die. Speaks of the fact that there was this pain that started within. And give some indication of this. Could it be something in maybe a small sense of what was happening, worms eating and all the rest, of the punishment, the judgment that comes from making the statement that he did? And it seems that as I look at it more and more, I become convinced of the fact that it is metaphoric because of the language. It's not to be literal, because otherwise you wouldn't use the language of the undying worm and all the rest. It's something a little bit different. And yet it's the idea that it continues forever and ever, whatever it is, and the process of eating away at you goes on and on and on. And I tend to look at that and I begin to think, what would it be like? Some of you might have the video, What Dreams Are Made Of. And you might think of Robin Williams in there. It's a lousy portrayal of heaven, but there's a nice portrayal to an extent of what hell would be like. A woman who is lonely and is in her room and continuously in loneliness and pity and all of the rest through her life. I wonder what it would be like in terms of that. See, I really see it fitting into the attributes of God and perhaps explaining it a little bit better. First of all, I don't think, in fact, I'm going to say I know, that man is not destroyed or annihilated. Number one, it doesn't make any difference what word you would use. You could use apolumi, apoleia, you could use alethros. Whatever phrase you use is going to fail. You're not going to be able to demonstrate it scripturally. Number two, I'm going to tell you that God has created each human being with intrinsic value. Now, God has intrinsic worth and value. That is, in and of His own nature. Extrinsic would mean that we derive our value from God. But with regard to man, He created us in His image. And it makes every person valuable. So that even when God looks at the sinner, it's not a matter that He's going to destroy him because man is valuable. I think it was Bill Gaither that once said, maybe it was Gloria Gaither, who said, God don't make no junk. That's right. Every human being has intrinsic worth, and God is not going to destroy that individual. J.P. Moreland argues it well in one of his books. So the idea of intrinsic value, you know, not going to destroy. But God is a loving God. God created us with the capacity to make a choice. I don't want to fight over Calvinism and all the rest, but I would say that the fact is, biblically, in terms of it, that there is something to be said for the actualness of belief and all of that. And I do hold to a lot of Calvinism. I'm not 5-point, but that's okay. I'm going to be there anyway. Okay. But in terms of it, as I think of it, the loving thing. For God to say, you know, you made your choice. You wanted to live without me? Go ahead. Except it's not just going to be in this lifetime, it's going to be forever and ever. You wanted to do the things you did? You know? You can live with it forever and ever. In a sense, love, if we understand biblical love, goes something like this. That God has the highest honor and best interest for the person that He loves. But in a sense, what He's saying to that person is, this is the way you are. You've chosen this. And so you can continue on the way that you are. Mercifulness of God? Well, let me tell you what mercy is. Don't put them in heaven. Because can you imagine what a person who is a sinner would be like walking around in heaven before the holiness of God? It wouldn't be a pleasant sight. God's graciousness, allowing him to continue. Isn't that what you read in Revelation 21 when you talk about those who are outside the city? Didn't C.S. Lewis have a point, although I think he stretches it too far, when he says, you know, God lets them out of heaven, out of hell, and lets them walk into the heavenly city. Well, I don't think he does. But it's an interesting concept because they'll walk through and go back because they couldn't live in heaven. They're not made to be that way. But what would it be like to think of the idea that we would be incomplete? Whereas in the biblical picture, God wipes away the tears. There is no more sickness and illness. Things are past. And then to think of the other side, God allows them to continue the way that they have chosen. Because they have intrinsic value, God doesn't destroy them. He allows them to continue. And as that happens, a horrible thing to think of. And there are lots of pictures that people have put in. Suppose they were an alcoholic, they remain an alcoholic forever and ever and ever. What would that be like? What would it be like? And so the metaphoric view, in a sense, indicates the fact that it's horrible. It's probably worse than being burned by fire. In what you go through and incompleteness. That's a horrible picture to think about. But yet, it indicates the fact that God is loving, God maintains His justice, God is holy, God is righteous, God's mercy and God's grace have been demonstrated, and there's no conflict with that whatsoever. So Charles Taze Russell, in a sense, struggled with two things. Number one, talking about the love of God over any other. What about the justice of God? that demands punishment for sin. What about that? What about the holiness of God? What about His righteousness? How easy it is to do those types of things, even in our culture today. But is it possible to have all of the attributes come together in the final result of punishment? I think it is. But where it does take place is in a view that's a little bit different than the way you were brought up in the watchtower with the idea of accusing us of putting a dog on a spittle and roasting him. Or as one Jehovah's Witness said to me one time, it's a nice daughter you have. I have twins. They're now 25 years of age. Would you take her down there when she does something wrong and put her hand in the fire and burn it? Would you do that every day because she did it today? And you know, I thought about that for a while, and I said, it certainly does get you emotive, doesn't it? He's lucky he went out with a straight face, not a flat face. You know, I mean, it gets to you when they say things like that. But you know, the more I think about it, nothing ceases. The fire doesn't cease. This thing goes on eternally. Things continue to eat away and eat away and eat away forever and ever. It's a pretty horrible thing when you begin to consider it. Don't like loneliness? You'll suffer with it forever and ever. So I begin to think about that and I start to say, and I think that fits. Because in any literal fire, the worm would burn. And the fire would go out. But in hell it doesn't. It's a terrible picture. And if you don't think that there is torment in whatever, then think perhaps of that parable, I call it a parable, in Luke 16. Or if you want to think worse, think further on. And think of the passage in Revelation 20:10. By the way, it's a long period of time, isn't it? The beast and false prophet are thrown in. 1,000-year period has ended, they're still there. It's kind of a slow burn, isn't it? And for those of you that are a-mill and post-mill, since 1,000 years would be longer because it would be from the ascension of Christ until the eternal state, that's over 2,000 years now. So you burn a little bit longer if that happens to be your view. But it doesn't seem that you get away from the aspect of eternal punishment. You don't. So those are the things that, in looking back at Russell, I wish, you know, in a sense, he had balanced the attributes. And I wish people today would do the same thing, too. And I wish we would learn how to look at the Bible and to be able to interpret it properly, to use guidelines like this. We would no more say, you know, that Herod was a red fox and Jesus was rye bread than we would want to say, when it talks about hell, that it's literal fire, to put it that way. But nonetheless, if you hold the first view, that's fine, because God certainly can do anything. But I think it's more the second view, and that's what I'd like you to think a little bit about, because it will help you to explain all the attributes. The first view of literal is kind of difficult to put all the attributes together. In what sense would God be loving and yet put them through a literal fire? And you say, love means he seeks the best in the object of his love. How would he be loving? Well, some of you that are Calvinistic would probably say, well, he seeks the best in the object of his love, which is the elect, me, not them. Cop out. It won't work, but it's a nice try anyway. Okay. So as I see it, Charles Taze Russell, there's how it comes right on through to today. And we struggled with this, you know. Held the doctrines we held, ran into this encounter with this infidel. It changed everything. And right from the beginning, yeah, there was no longer the idea of thinking of hell as the, rather of eternal torment. But arguing that God is loving, that's impossible. Cannot be. And taking the fire as literal and making fun of it. And that's exactly where we ended up. So the two responses to it is all the attributes belong to God together. He is all of them, and one does not supersede the other. And secondly, it could be literal, but look at the metaphoric view, because I think it puts together all the things that you ask questions about. That's all that I ask. Okay.